I'll never forget the first moment when I walked into a cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the Scan On Podcast, your weekly look at the world of film news, Irish and international. I'm Darren Mooney, and joining me are...
Grace.
Roman.
And Luke.
And this week we're going to talk about the usual. We're going to talk about the week in film news, we're going to talk about the top 10 and the new releases, but let's start with what we normally do. So Grace, what have you watched since last we talked?
I'm trying to remember now.
On went the spot, in a bit of no
a
pressure.
Yeah, I went in a bit of a DVD bender in one of those CEX places on Saturday, so I got a ton of stuff. Oh yes, I rewatched Infinity War for the first time since the cinema, finally. And I love it. I just like to reiterate how much I love it. It holds up surprisingly well on revisit too. I think it's actually one of those things that's easier to watch the second or third time because you can actually pause and appreciate the various individual storylines when it feels less like everything is mashed together in one. Mm-hmm. So that was fun to revisit. And then, I watched Man on Fire, which I got for the princely sum of 50 cent in CEX. So I just like to throw that out there.
Yeah.
Bargain. Really enjoyed it. I've seen the first half hour of it about four times, and it's always on really late in film four, so I've never finished it. So I finally got to see the rest, and I was kind of surprised at how dark it got.
Really?
In places. Well, I mean, I was expecting a certain level of violence. I wasn't expecting, spoiler alert, Denzel to shoot someone's fingers off at some
stage. Or to put an explosive inside of someone, I think.
Yes,
another
indeed.
One of those.
That was very impressive.
You have not seen this, you have a treat.
The man got on fire with
explosive insights.
Yes, with one of those fine, like, slow motion walking away from explosions thing going on, because nobody can be as cool as Denzel.
Well, yeah, it's the entire basis of the Equalizer franchise is that somebody saw Man on Fire and decided, what if we did that, but we took a lot of the art out of it.
Yeah.
And replaced it with, like, The Old Man and the Sea.
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, it's a Tony Scott movie, which I always forget, so it's shot really beautifully, and it has loads of saturated colors and really heightened performances, and it's very good. And I like all the various kind of spiritual and religious undertones going on there, too. It makes it a little bit more intense. And then... I feel like I watched something else on Sunday, and oh yes, I rewatched Fast and Furious 8, which is an iconic masterpiece, obviously, the likes of which may never be equaled. It's so good. I loved it. Like, I loved it when I saw it in the cinema, but this is the first time I've seen it since then. And yeah, it's funnier than I remember. It whips by. It's so good. The franchise is perfect.
My personal favorite moment in Fate of the Furious is the moment where, because The Rock and Vin Diesel were not talking to one another on set, they have their big dramatic showdown with one another from inside cars parked on the other side of a street through megaphones. It's amazing. It's right up there with the moment where The Rock kicks a torpedo.
Mm-hmm. And of course,
that really happens.
Yes, and I thought we could just make stuff up.
Yes.
Yeah, we could just make stuff up and Ronan would be completely. Yes.
If there's one man I can believe kicking a torpedo.
Indeed, I think my my housemate came home around the point and was just like, "Oh, this looks interesting." There's kicking of torpedoes going on. But also that 6 or 7 minute sequence of Jason Statham rescuing the baby on the plane.
Yes, that is quite adorable.
That cinematic highlight.
And
I'd like to see anyone try and top that.
And Helen Mirren's long sought after cameo. She aggressively pursued the idea of a cameo in a Fast and Furious movie for, I think, the better part of half a decade.
And she got to swear.
And when she did, she was really disappointed she didn't get to drive a car.
Aww.
Well, what's the point?
I know.
I feel like they could have put her driving a car in there too, but there's already a lot going on, so maybe there wasn't enough room for that.
That's they're saving that for the sequel.
Indeed, yes. So I think that's my week in film.
Nice.
We can move on.
So Ronan.
So after my appalling performance last week, I think I'd seen almost nothing when we came to this point last week. I had one of those weeks where I just repeatedly went and hid in films because life is really awful and all the news is terrifying and awful. Mm. So Friday night, I just went home, turned off my phone, threw it away, and started going through movies. And I watched Ingrid Goes West, which,
I
caught up with it.
It's
really good. Yeah. It's a lot of fun, really funny. I think it's a really interesting role for Aubrey Plaza because she's been misused in some ways. I think she's terrific in Parks and Rec, and it does something really interesting with her. It's, and something she was always really good at doing in Parks and Rec. Is sort of having this strange sympathy underneath her that she has this sort of outward aggressiveness that is really defensive in a way. Mm-hmm. And the film does something really, really interesting with that. It's really smart. It's kind of obvious at points, but that's part of the point because that's the nature of the world we live in. I really, really enjoyed it.
Mm. It's so scathing.
Yeah,
like,
it is.
It's completely unforgiving of the type of people at Lampoon's.
It's totally vicious. Mm-hmm. And it felt a lot of times like several Black Mirror episodes, but, you know, much more multifaceted than that.
Yeah. And also more reflective of the world that we actually live in, which is kind of depressing of itself.
No, absolutely.
This is how it all began. And then a few years in the future, Black Mirror. Mm-hmm.
It would have been really easy to just kind of make Aubrey Plaza's character the kind of, like, to kind of dump on her character and kind of not give her that kind of sympathetic eye. I think it really kind of speaks to the favor that it did.
Yeah.
You know, she's not just the weirdo or...
Yeah, exactly, and it's kind of rooted in the idea that we're all a little bit like this. We all have this experience of our crazy digital world. You know, there are aspects of... There are performative aspects to all of the way we present our lives now. Mm-hmm. And it's really, really smart about doing that, and hugely enjoyable.
Yeah, and I kind of love the way it starts off by making her seem like a total nutcase, and then towards the end, she actually comes across as one of the saner people that's surrounding her.
Yeah.
She's almost a Batman fetish, so...
Iconic.
That kind of stuff is really funny.
A film that justly recognizes the significance and value of Batman Forever, also, I'd like to put up. No shade being thrown at anyone here.
Batman Forever is the worst Batman movie. The best thing about Justice League is that it maybe opens up the debate on whether Batman Forever is the worst movie with Batman in it. Maybe.
Mm. Don't be so silly. Honestly.
Why so serious, Chris? Why so serious? So what else, Ron?
But to follow on from Ingrid Goes West, I went for this like movie marathon on Friday night because I was extremely tired and just worn down, and it took me a long time to decide in Ingrid Goes West because I was just flicking through things as you do these days on a Now TV thing that my housemate has picked up because we don't have regular TV anymore, and I was skipping through it and I was like, yeah, I've heard that's great, fine, I'll watch it. And I was so opposed to actually having to decide another one that at one point in Ingrid Goes West they mentioned Single White Female, and I knew that that was on it. So I was like, right, that's it. I'll watch that next. Went and watched Single White Female. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And was hoping throughout, I was like, will Single White Female mention another film? It has clips from loads of films, including In a Lonely Place, which I love. But I got really tired after that and went to bed. But Single White Female is really good. I really, really enjoyed it. Really interesting play.
Have you seen it before?
No, I hadn't.
Oh. I haven't seen it.
It's a really interesting play on the sort of 80s, 90s erotic thriller. Yeah. It's... really beautifully shot. Brad Schroeder does amazing work with it.
Yeah, it's one of those underrated 90s sort of serial killer sort of psychological thriller.
Yeah, I was flicking through Letterboxd and a couple of reviews from the time, and it was sort of almost dismissed as a De Palma knockoff. I think it's really, really smart. It's doing a lot of incredibly intelligent things. Great, great performances. And it's this weird flip on the basic instinct thing where you get that moment of, you know, you see full frontal male nudity, which still at the point in the 90s was pretty rare for relatively mainstream films. I had a lot of fun with that one. And then I wish I had gone on to watch In a Lonely Place as well, but like I said, very tired.
We're all getting very old. And we need to go to bed early.
Getting worn down by all this. The rest of the week I didn't actually manage to catch too much, but on Sunday I had a very similar thing. I just had enough. So I went and bought 4 tickets to 4 films in the Lighthouse and stayed there for 10 hours, and it was glorious. One of them is in the top 10, so we'll save that for then. But the first one I watched was Leave No Trace, caught up on. It's still going, actually. It's done quite well.
Beautiful.
It's managed to stay around for a long time. It's really, really good. Deborah Granick's latest. It's another one of these films. She did, of course, Winter's Bone, which was back in 2010 or something, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And she's only done one film since, a documentary called Stray Dog, about motorcyclists in America. Sort of same region as both of these fiction films, which was really, really great. I don't think ever got a release here, but played at some festivals. All three of the films work together in this really interesting way, that they're sort of about this very stereotypical view of America, sort of draped in flags, Americana, but pushed to the margins by this new sort of technical age, you know, on the peripheries of cities, very much this sort of inland thing. Leave No Trace, I really liked. There were various points where I thought it was going to go off in a direction that didn't quite work. It could, you know, there's room for it to be heavy-handed, but it's very subtle about this. You know, it takes a while to realize what's going on with the characters. There's very little speech at a lot of points, and it's carried by two terrific performances. Yeah. Ben Foster, I think, is great. He's always...
He's one of the more underrated.
Extremely
sort of
intense, yeah. Ever since, you know, 6 Feet Under, years and years ago, he's always had this amazing intensity about him, and he's really given a chance to shine here. I really like this one.
It seems to have sort of disappeared under the radar.
Yeah, it really has, and it's a shame. It's the kind of thing you can imagine
had it been released later in the year, I mean,
well, that's
one of the things I can't understand is why it didn't get an awards season.
It sort of just floated out at a strange point. It's interesting that it's still hanging around in cinema. I think it may be gone now. That may have been its last week, but it's stuck around the Lighthouse a long time.
Yeah.
So I think it must have gone down well with people. But it is. It's that kind of mid-tier American drama that you don't get to see a huge amount of anymore.
Yeah.
You can't see it anymore, but.
Yeah, you can wait for the DVD. It's like, this is like when watching Mubi. It's like, well, I only watched it because it was leaving, but it was great. Mubi. So if it comes back, watch it.
We'll come to some faded Mubi, don't worry.
Oh, okay.
Moving on. Right after that, I went into Cold War, the Pavel Pavlikovsky film, literally about 10 minutes later. Because, that's what happens when you try to see four films all at once. It's great. I loved Ida. It was one of my favorite films that year. Ida? What are we saying?
Ida. Ida.
Yeah. I can't remember from the film itself. I'm sure they probably say her name. Let's go with Ida.
We'll get an angry correction, I'm sure.
Yeah, no doubt.
But the great thing about pronunciation corrections on Twitter is that you can just read them however you want.
Mm-hmm. Ida was terrific. Made my top five of that year, I'm sure, the year it came out. And I'm no major Pavlikovsky fan. I think the last film he did before that, The Woman in the Fifth, with Ethan Hawke, and... remember. It's awful anyway.
Ethan Hawke's in it and it's awful. That's all you need to know, apparently.
But you get to Ida, and Ida is absolutely great. I really love it. Like, that excess of overhead space, the aesthetic in it is really fascinating. And what's really interesting about Cold War is that in large part, you could imagine criticisms being leveled at Pavlikovsky of just doing the same thing. It's the same aspect ratio, same general setting, same tone in a lot of ways. But he does something really different with it. He's got, and that was the case in the previous film as well, but he really leans into the rhythms of jazz. The editing is quite erratic and all over the place. It spans quite a long period, I think something like 15 years. And it's really edited in a way that is, I think, deliberately trying to wrong-foot you, that you don't quite know,
where you are immediately.
Yeah. It has year headings, but at various points, like, well, what's happened in the cut we just had? But it creates this amazing rhythm of a romance, and obviously it's sort of paired. The personal romance, which is really affecting, is also paired with the idea of the way the world is progressing during the Cold War. This sort of amazing feeling of, oh, are we about to get over this? Oh, no, we're back to it. And it's really good about the way it does that. Two really, really strong performances. And again, music factors into it really well. There are a couple of shots right at the start of it of an abandoned church. You can just about make out like faded eyes painted on a wall. And has this sense of the burden of people watching and waiting for things to fall apart. This romance is really closely watched by a lot of people. And it stands in as a really interesting metaphor for the Cold War. I'm really impressed with it. It's a lot of people are highlighting it as one of the best films of the year, and I kind of have to agree at this point. But it's interesting the extent to which it's really, really similar. Like, it forms a sort of two-piece with Pavlikovsky's previous film, and it feels very, very different at the same time. He's managed to make one of those really interesting sort of back-to-back packages that reflect off each other in a strange way. Watch together, they inform each other.
They're both quite short as well.
They are. This was under 90 minutes, which is terrific for a four-film.
Make it fairly, and for one that covers 15 years, and one which you would watch.
And that's the thing. That's the really interesting thing about the editorial rhythms of it. That it covers a really long period of time. It would be easy for it to feel fleeting, but it doesn't. You feel the full expanse of this romance, and even though it's only covered in the space of like a minute between, you might be covering 3 years where characters don't see each other. At one point, the man is in a concentration camp, but you really feel the weight of the emotion. It's really, really intelligently done, and the music is absolutely terrific as well. Moved on to that. We'll come to the fourth one, but this was a really, really good day in the cinema. There's a lot of good stuff at the moment. But the third film was not good. Sicilian Ghost Story, the Italian.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I've heard
conflicting things.
Yeah, it's got reasonably good reviews. It's been sort of highlighted as one of these films in the Guillermo del Toro mold of sort of the conflict of war seen through childhood eyes, although there's not war in this case, it's just the mafia. It's kind of all over the place. It just didn't work for me at all. There's a lot of weird conflicting things going on. It's in this sort of magic realist mold, and it's difficult at times to tell what's real and what's not. There are sort of apparitions of... The story is this 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 pair of young kids sort of start this fleeting romance. One of them disappears because he's the son of a local politician. He's been kidnapped by the mafia, and his wasn't quite his girlfriend is crying out saying, why aren't people looking for him? And there's this strange thing going on where she starts to have dreams where she can see him, and she knows there's a reality to it, so she starts seeking out the place where he might be. It really doesn't ever seem to work. It relies a lot on its performers, and they don't quite stack up. I'm talking about the adult performers here. The kids are quite good, but there's a really overplayed role for the young girl's mother, who has this really stilted performance that doesn't work with what the film is going for. She's also, like, it's shoehorned in at one point, I think, that her mother is Portuguese, because it's one of these European co-productions where you have to make clear that you've had some money from Portugal. So this person is Portuguese, and... ugh. I mean, it's great that we have co-production across the continent, but sometimes it leaves you in weird things. You get the great things like the stuff...
that wouldn't get made otherwise,
yeah,
for
so
example.
You get things like The Lobster, where you have this weird Greek-Irish connection, and then you also get these Euro puddings where, oh God, no, it's fine, but... there are some moments of it, of like genuine visual imagination. It has an opening 5 minutes where I really sort of lean forward, like, what's going on here? And then kind of totally loses track. Fourth film of the day capped it off very well, but we'll come to that in the top ten. Mm. And the only other thing I watched this week, I will be done soon.
Obligatory movie reference.
The movie reference. I flopped down one night and put on whatever was about to expire, which was in this case the original Cape Fear from the 60s, which I'd never seen. It's years and years and years since I saw the Scorsese, but the original is great. It's really, really good. This amazing, I mean, it makes sense for the early 60s, but there's this amazing raw sexuality about it, where you see Robert Mitchum with his top off a lot. It's like you're associating with classical Hollywood because they're, you know, Gregory Peck and Robert Mitchum, but it's at this point of transition where it was sort of okay to be a bit weird about things and be more overt in the sexuality of your male characters. It's really interesting. And, of course, you got that amazing Bernard Herrmann score. I was kind of struck, like I say, I haven't seen the Scorsese in years and years and years, but by my memory of it, it seems to skew quite close to the original.
Yeah.
There doesn't seem much difference, which would make sense. Scorsese is a big fan of these kind of things. Yeah.
I don't think Scorsese ever was planning to improve upon it.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting, because I've sort of wondered of all the films in Scorsese's filmography. That one was the one that always seemed kind of strange to me, because it seems like he loved the original very, very much. What was he planning to do with it? I love the film. I think it's great. I think the performances are fantastic. I think it's one of those great B-movies in that it's a perfectly made piece of schlock.
Yeah, it really is.
And I don't mean that in a dismissive sort of way. It's perfectly crafted, great attention to detail. But I always wondered what the objective was, the point was, because it's not quite like Psycho levels of remake, but it's still... strange.
Yeah, it's interesting. I suppose at that point, Scorsese hadn't had a major hit for a while, and it was his first time being with De Niro in quite a while, wasn't it?
Was it after Goodfellas, I thought, right?
Oh, was it? The chronology. Jesus,
let me just check.
Goodfellas was 90, and this was 91. Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right there.
Gasps of De Niro's dignity, probably.
hey,
De Niro.
Well, actually, we might get to that in what I've watched.
Oh, okay, all right.
I'll hand over.
De Niro's last gasp is spared.
Well, one of the last gasps. You know, you can occasionally come up for a bit of air, because one thing that I finished this week, it took a couple of goes on Netflix, but I got there in the end, was The Intern. The Nancy Myers movie, which is really sweet. I quite liked it. I think it's probably one of the times in the last couple of years where De Niro is trying and is pretty good. Like, it's... Yeah.
He seems to enjoy the change of pace of it.
Well, they gave him some semblance of a decent character as well. Like, I mean, not that he's like the most intricate character ever written, but you know, you get a sense of personality and history, and you know, he has a really nice kind of quiet presence or something in it that's just so different to what we've seen him make for the past couple of years, and it's really nice and refreshing.
Which is kind of what the movie is very much going for, in that his character is from a kind of forgotten era, or a lost era of
masculinity,
the working world and the kind of man at work kind of thing. But rather than playing that in a really obnoxious,
condescending kind of
way, it kind of
it
takes him seriously. It does a bit.
Not through him, though, which I sort of appreciate. Yeah. But there's a weird thing around him.
Some of the advice that he gives.
Yes. And the moment where Anne Hathaway is talking about how, you know, why can't men be like the men who used to be around Hollywood? And you're like, that moment hasn't aged particularly well in the past couple of years.
Not at all.
No.
There's a lot of that in Nancy Meyers movies, though. She has a bit of a preoccupation, shall we say, with classic Hollywood and role models and gender roles, too, which is fascinating because she always writes films from the perspective of, like, a super white second class feminist. Where it's like, this sounds good in theory, but it's a mess in reality. But, you know, her heart is, I think, in the right place.
Yeah, and Anne Hathaway is probably the perfect.
She's not Annie Banks McKenzie kind of, from Father of the Bride.
But, you know, I feel like it's well written enough. It takes these characters seriously as people, which you wouldn't necessarily think going into a movie where Robert De Niro is an old person. Like everything else he's doing.
Who works at a tech startup.
Mm-hmm. And he brings a briefcase, and they all love this.
Yeah. I think
they start having briefcases afterwards.
What would you put in it?
My iPad.
He has like a calculator and everything in it. Like he comes equipped with
he has like hats and he has like little legal pads and stuff like that. But yeah, you wonder what the men, what the guys in the office who have briefcases afterwards are putting in their briefcases.
But it's like you think it should be patronizing, and it kind of is a little bit. But you know, it's very sweet. It is one of his best performances, I think, in a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
He's not being a dirty grandpa. He's an actual person with his life feels lived in. It's well written enough to that point. There are kind of the usual things that you would get from a Nancy Meyers that are negatives, but there's also kind of the positives in there as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a style of filmmaking that doesn't really exist that much anymore. Yeah. Like I remember thinking that the romance between himself and Rene Russo is perfectly formulaic and conventional, but you see that sort of story so rarely now that it seems almost novel. So
yeah, and quite comparable, I think, to Book Club from this year, and the way that that kind of goes through its romances with Diane Keaton and Andy Garcia. Kind of very similar.
Very
to that.
Formulaic, very conventional, but again, that formula is so rarely even bothered with these days that it's almost thrilling to see two people fall very slowly and affectionately in love with one another without any sort of strange technological related complaint.
I mean it I think it's perfect for Netflix. Like I watched it in a couple of goes. It's that kind of film, and it worked pretty well. Another thing that I finally watched recently might be in the top 10, so that's Ant-Man and the Wasp. I don't know what's in the top 10. I never do. I'm a bad researcher in some areas.
I don't believe it's in the top 10, so we can talk about it.
Okay, yeah, that's pretty good. I mean,
it's fallen so far under the radar, though.
I think it had a very small release. I think it's sort of its box office figures.
But was that like some sort of viral marketing to give it a small release?
It's because it came out like 3 years ago in the States.
Yeah.
And they just
all the buzz had already passed.
Because of stop it.
It just felt like a real non-event. You know, sometimes you get films like that and you sort of hear about them, and in theory people are excited about them, but nobody really is, and they just sort of seem to pass you by.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't even know it was out a couple of weeks ago, because we got a trailer for it in the cinema, I think 2 weeks ago, and I had this moment where I was like, oh, I thought that was out already, and it turns out it was out already, but they're still playing the trailer for it, which clearly is not helping.
Yeah. So, it does feel kind of a bit contractually obligated on the studio's part.
Mm-hmm.
We said we were going to do this, and then
Guess we're doing this. But I mean,
it's
charming, inoffensive, perfectly formulaic. The cast are wonderfully engaging. Like, I mean, it has perhaps the most overqualified cast of any superhero film I've seen in years.
And it's fun enough. It's an entertaining way to pass a couple of hours. But what I would say is that if you kind of built this as Ant-Man and the Wasp, and you've ended your previous film with the whole thing of, no, this time we're actually going to have the Wasp. It's coming. Like, I didn't really get enough of that, I don't think, really. It's, you know...
I think the issue is that the setup of the premise is that the Wasp is the more conventional, like, Marvel Universe competent superhero.
Yeah.
And so if you shift the emphasis too much to her, you lose Paul Rudd, who is, you know, whose primary defining feature is that he's maybe slightly not as good at it as everybody else in these movies.
Paul Rudd is like Dante and Clerks in this movie. Doesn't want to be there. He's not supposed to be there. That's pretty much his role in the universe itself. But when the whole... They have an emotional through line in the story, which is that you know, the Wasp wants to reconnect with her mother who's been lost in Tinyland. And, you know, that those are two talented actresses. That's an emotional through line. And
it's just spend no time together.
It's crammed in at the very end. And it's like, that's your movie. Like, I don't understand why that's not the story.
Yeah.
And because you can, Marvel.
Yeah. And, you know, you can have Paul Rudd involved in that.
But just not as the lead.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of like the irony a co-lead.
Like, kind of like Ant-Man and Wasp.
Yeah. The gas part is, I would have expected them to learn from, like, Civil War, where Ant-Man works best as, like, the sort of tertiary supporting character who pops up every now and then fecks off again.
Yeah.
Like, that could have been a guideline to them. But nevertheless.
Imagine underusing Michelle Pfeiffer.
Just. Really, and Lawrence Fishburne, and Randall Park, and Michael Pena, Michael Douglas.
Michelle Pfeiffer has so much capital at the moment for that incredible Mother performance, which just, like, I didn't hate Mother by any means, but every time Michelle Pfeiffer was on screen, I was like, yes, this is a great
film.
Feed
me.
Like, come back.
Hey, there was lots to love in there, I think.
Okay. We're not going to start talking about
Mother. Okay, we're not going to talk about Mother. Let's not hit the Mother load. All right, what else do you watch?
Well, I think we'll probably end up using the rest of our time because you and I both saw something that's not out for...
It's not out until next week, but let's talk about it now. So myself and Luke have both seen Mile 22, which is wall-to-wall burger action.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know about you, but I hated Mile 22.
Even the title sounds...
Mile 22 is
not... What's the title mean?
Okay, so... I mean, I think that they definitely had another title and they had to change it. Because in Mile 22, Mark Wahlberg and
there's very clearly
his crew of kind of government ops, which includes Ronda Rousey and Lauren Cohen from The Walking Dead.
Yes, yes.
And
other people.
Jabronis.
Extras.
They're named Overwatch.
Yes.
And so the movie was definitely at one point called Overwatch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's like a video game.
Until Overwatch happened.
Yeah. And so, I had to very quickly change it.
So, Mile 22...
And that's the best alternative title they could come up with.
It feels like they put more effort into that alternate title than a lot of the movies.
Should have been titled Say Hi to Your Mother for Me.
Yeah. This is the thing. It's not a good movie. It's Peter Berg, who is directing in his most sort of Peter Berg mayhem style. Lots of quick editing, lots of cuts. He can't keep individual faces in the frame. It's remarkable. There are moments where characters are conversing and delivering exposition in which he cuts so rapidly that you don't just get line, reaction, line. You get line, reaction, reaction to reaction, reaction to reaction to reaction, line. And it's dizzying and sort of blustering and chaotic. And what's weird is that that works better in those exposition scenes and scenes of characters in corridors where the camera's sort of shaky and cutting in and zooming, which is like creates this weird tension in bureaucratic office scenes that shouldn't be there. And you're kind of like, this is odd. I go with it, as compared to the action sequences, which are just a jumble of stuff that happens.
They're incomprehensible. They really are. And it's, the film has Iko Uwais from,
The Raid.
The Raid movies, both as a star and
talk
also
about delusions of grandeur.
The stunt choreographer, and it's really depressing because the stunt choreographer, from what you can see, is really great, and why wouldn't it be? But it's just a complete waste of his time because
it gets lost in the
completely lost. It feels like the action scenes just got worse and worse the longer the movie.
Oh, they did. They did. Like, I mean, the opening scene that introduces what his character is capable of is relatively competent. It has longer takes than the other sequence. And Luke is looking at me, for listeners. He's glaring at me like Mark Wahlberg would glare at somebody who had insulted his intelligence in this movie. Mark Wahlberg, by the way, plays a character who is a genius, who thinks so hard that people cannot keep up with him. He has to slow down. There's a moment in the opening credits. There's no character development in the film. All of it's overlaid over the opening credits, in which his parents explain to him that he has an issue, and his issue is that his brain moves too fast. Which is something to behold, but it's,
all I can picture is him screaming at his mother in Boogie Nights now.
Yeah, it's
when the movie tells you that Mark Wahlberg is the smartest character in it in the two first couple of minutes. That's when you know you should really leave.
Yeah, what's interesting though is I don't hate it as much as Luke did, if only because I detect the faint glimmers of self-awareness in there somewhere, in that without getting too spoilerific, it's a movie that hinges upon two Mark Wahlberg memes. You can tell that the script was almost fashioned backwards from two Mark Wahlberg-related social media punchlines. And they were like, okay, we're going to build a movie based around Mark Wahlberg's famous "Say hi to your mother for me," and the idea that if he was on the plane on September 11, things would have gone differently. And it's just something to behold. It's like the most long-form, convoluted, completely unnecessary setup to those two punchlines that you can imagine. And I almost appreciate that enough to forgive the shaky camera work and terrible editing that gets us to that point.
I love your generosity with these things, but well, I'm not sure, see, I can credit
it. That's what I found so frustrating, is that I could definitely see a kind of entertaining, schlocky action movie in there somewhere, because it's a very simple premise. They've got this guy, they've got to get him to the
airfield in a certain amount of time while everybody else is trying to kill him. It's
22 miles away. They're in a foreign country. Everyone there is corrupt and trying to kill them.
Yeah.
They're very pointedly nonspecific about where it takes place.
Yeah.
It takes place in the country of Indokar, I think you'll find.
Was that not the city?
No, it's actually the
Indokar.
So yeah. I think it's not real.
Thank you for our non-geography.
I didn't take geography for that evening. So.
But I'm fairly sure it's like Kumar from the West Wing. They sort of neighbor one another. Yeah, it's not a good
film. Yeah, it could have been a perfectly fine action movie as long as it wasn't directed by Peter Berg and it didn't star Mark Wahlberg. I can't emphasize enough how irritating I found Mark Wahlberg in this film.
There's an amazing sequence where one of the team members has a birthday and somebody brings over some cake for her. And Wahlberg, who's in the middle of a rant about this really horrible operation that went terribly wrong, proceeds to, with the back of his hand, swipe the birthday cake and plate off the table with enough force to shatter it against the wall, and declares, "No birthday cake!" This is a character establishing moment for him.
That he hates cake?
Yeah. He's a monster.
He loves his job at Overwatch so much, and it's like to the point where he tells Lauren Cohen, like, why would you want time off with your daughter? Like, this is great. I love it here.
This is my Club Med, he says, on the top of a balcony that's patrolled by armed men. Yeah. And that's even before we get
because
into...
Because he's a psychopath. Like, he is a psychopath, but I can... It's a movie, so I can forgive a character being a psychopath, but I could not forgive his character for never shutting up.
Oh my god, he goes on and on. One of the things they do to cover up the fact the story is so simple, and I apologize for this taking up so much time in the podcast, but it's amazing. One of the things they do to cover up the fact that this is such a simple premise is they actually have sequences in which they cut non-linearly to a debriefing sequence in which his character, instead of explaining what's actually happening during the film to the experts in his field for the recording equipment that, you know, they've set up, instead monologues at great length about warfare. Doesn't really exist anymore as you people think about it. Battlefield. What does that even mean? Two people in a room. That's a battlefield. And you're like, Mr. Wahlberg, if you just answered the questions, this would probably make a lot more sense.
What is a question?
Yeah.
So nobody ever asked him any questions during the interrogation, which was what was so frustrating.
Yeah.
It's just, if you, like, I know that there was a script, but it's like they asked Mark Wahlberg to vamp for time.
Yeah.
And all he can talk about is action and fighting. There was a script, because I did look it up. The script was written by a writer called Leah Carpenter, who's a novelist. She's a literary publisher, and then she wrote a novel called 11 Days after being dared to by a friend to write 10,000 words before a certain date. So it's that kind of level.
What, like it's hard?
Airport novel kind of thing. Her novel is about a guy who goes missing on the same day that Bin Laden is raided. So she's... You can see this.
Have you ever seen them in the same room together?
That's really... What is a room, really?
What is this dimension? Is everything a flat circle?
But like, if Gareth Evans had directed this, it would have been fine.
Very enjoyable. Yeah. You
probably wouldn't have had Mark Wahlberg in it either, which would have been
great. Yeah, there's some choice Wahlberg moments in there. None of them are particularly good. There's the moment.
Is there such a thing as a good Wahlberg moment?
The other guys.
Was it Wahlberg who grabbed the guy's head and like pulled it
down? No, that was.
Okay, there is
one of the things.
Although calling it awful feels mean because it was boring more so than anything else.
Yeah.
Sorry, we're talking about the other guys, which we did not enjoy.
It's not good. It's no fun.
But this is kind of like the other guys of the government.
Yeah. Well, that's it, because...
That's what their team is.
The total premise of the movie is option one is diplomacy. Option two is military. Option three is apparently also military.
Press star to hear these options again.
Yeah.
So it's out next week.
It is out next
week. It's bad, don't see it.
Yeah, okay. Let's draw a line under this.
It's a 2-week lead into not going to it.
Yeah. So other than that, I watched Beauty and the Beast last night.
Hooray!
It was beautiful.
Tale as old as time.
From lows to highs.
Yes, sadly, one of those movies that wouldn't be improved by adding Mark Wahlberg to it. There are very few.
Oh my god.
Can you imagine?
Is Mark Wahlberg not just Gaston in real life, though?
Yeah, that is a fair point.
I think he has the charm to be Gaston.
But yeah, astonishingly beautiful film. First time I'd seen it in ages, and it still holds up. Obviously, everybody knows the song. We watched it, a bunch of myself and two other grown men, at midnight. Stuck it on, with the sing-along version on, and it was something to behold.
I hope you sobbed. I hope you sobbed by the end.
I don't think we really sobbed, but we all... Like,
manly tear.
Yeah, a little single drip, a little in the corner of the eye. There was just there was some spice in the air, you know. It was perfectly manly. But yeah, it was something to behold. And the lyrics... Like, even stuff that I'd forgotten. So, for example, no one plots like Gaston. No one, plays with lots like Gaston. No one takes advantage of local crackpots like Gaston. Again, so much fun. It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. I'm especially good at expectorating. I use antlers in all of my decorating. This is art, ladies and gentlemen. Like, this is the epitome of music as an art form.
It's possibly one of the films I've seen most in my life because it was one of a very small VHS collection that I watched again and again and again and again together with Matilda and Naked Gun 33 and a third.
That's relatively good combo. Choices.
Yeah. I could have done a lot worse, yeah. But I haven't seen it at this point in about possibly like 20 years.
I haven't seen it in a very long time either.
So having spoken to you about it earlier and you saying no, I'm absolutely watching it next
marathon.
Week. I really need this.
I'm not doing anything
again.
It's Saturday. I think this is what I'm going to do.
There was some talk around the Scan on Offices this morning of possibly setting up a separate podcast to discuss the Disney canon in great detail. It would mostly
be
us singing.
Setting aside 4 hours from me talking about Frances and the Frog.
Yeah.
I'll have 4 hours for Pocahontas, please.
All right, so let's move on to talk about the weekend film news. The big one this week, sort of international-wise, is the shuttering of the Village Voice over in New York, which was a big blow for film criticism, but also just for journalism in general.
Yeah. It's hosted a lot of major voices over the years, everyone from James Baldwin, E. Cummings, to a lot of key film voices. Like
it was founded by Norman Mailer.
One of the
trio who founded it
Well. So a lot of key literary voices broke through that way, even more modern voices like Colson Whitehead. So it's a big deal, and people are sort of using it as one of the signposts of the demise of journalism and all the rest, which I think is slightly blinkered, but it is no doubt a tragedy. A lot of really, really good current film writers have lost a home now, and I'm sure they'll land on their feet because they're great. But it is, it's a sad, sad.
It does illustrate the sort of changing dynamic there, because I think the paper was free, and it was run off an advertising model.
Yeah. So which is just extremely old hat at this point. And the reality is that these organizations have got to adapt.
Yeah.
And it's tough to do, but it has to be done. And there are plenty of sort of bodies littered along the way of people with great intentions. That
too busy complaining about BuzzFeed to do anything constructive.
Pretty much, yeah. At a certain point, you have to understand that things need to shift.
Mm-hmm.
And that's no fault of the journalists, of course. That's the ownership.
That's sort of a management.
It was bought by somebody incredibly rich, I believe, a couple of years back.
Yeah.
And who has now just dropped it because...
And doesn't want to maintain like an online version,
absolutely.
Yeah, I think they cut most of the staff except for a handful that will remain working on archiving.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, actually, when reporters visited the offices on the day in question after the announcement came through, because apparently the staff weren't expecting it.
Yeah.
All they found were a bunch of people sitting in cubicles ferrying big books of documents to and from the photocopier, which is a really depressing sort of picture of modern journalism.
Yeah. But it sounds like one of these places that has just not moved with the times whatsoever.
Yeah.
Like, you hear there was an announcement during the week that INM, who controls The Independent here, is going to move to a digital subscriptions model, and it's sort of like, welcome to 2012.
Yeah.
This is the way things have been going for a long time, and a lot of things are just dying off now because they haven't seen this coming, and there's been plenty of warning.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is a terrible shame for the great writers that have been there, but hopefully they will find homes, like all of the people from The Dissolve, which was just a sort of... not a great business model to begin with, although it had the backing of Pitchfork.
but Pitchfork also had its own issues as well. They're like, they've been on several satellite sites that have...
Condé Nast in general is having a tough time. Yeah. But hopefully all these people will get home. And I think the likes of Bill Gabeary will. He's a great writer.
Yeah.
And whoever picks him up is really lucky.
I like the idea that that's the takeaway. So right now, there are some really great options out there if you're willing to be predatory.
And they will be plucked up by a model that understands how to market this thing.
Yeah, eventually. Well, you hope. So anyway. Yeah. In other news, Colin Farrell has been named a patron of the Irish Film Festival London, joining Lenny Abramson as well. So he'll be basically participating in that as a sponsor and also as a sort of a name to attract sort of prestige to the festival as well, in order to give Irish talent the crucial opportunity to be seen on screen in one of the film industry's sort of largest hubs as well.
Will they stop calling Irish people British?
Yeah.
Maybe maybe then we might get somewhere.
There was a thing during the week where, and this is probably a silly bone of contention, but MUBI keep tweeting that certain films are available to view in, and they'll put the flags of every country, and stuff that's in Ireland, which has a different catalogue to Britain, has the UK flag.
Yeah.
Have they not got the memo?
Yeah.
Because an astonishing number of people really don't know.
Yeah. But I tweeted them saying, you realise we are a different country and we have a different catologue, and please include it, because there are people like me who want to know if it's on there. Yeah, they probably have at this point. I will never stop.
I love the idea that this is what set up the idea that there are lots of people in Britain who don't really accept that the island of Ireland exists as its own entity, unlike any other massive political movement that has taken place recently in this area. Amazon as well have that, which is really frustrating, where there are movies that are available on Amazon.co.uk, particularly on the Prime membership, which is available to Irish patrons, but which are not available in Irish markets, which is slightly frustrating when you've paid and been promised that it's there, but you're told that it's not actually because you're in a different market.
Amazon are bad anyway.
Oh, well, they're the first $1 trillion company, aren't they?
Yeah.
Announced this week.
Well, their workers are dying
under
their feet. Yeah. Capitalism, everyone.
But how do you think they became the world's first $1 trillion
industry? Precisely.
Soylent Green is people, ladies and gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
In other Irish film news, the new trailer for Paddy Brannock's Rosie was available online during the week. So that's well worth a look. If you're interested, this is premiering, I think, is it at... it's at the London Film Festival in October, and then it's also at the Toronto International Film Festival as well. So a lot of good buzz around this. Brannock's last one was Vida, I believe, wasn't it?
It was, I think, written by Mark Allen.
Which was something to behold. I think it closed the Dublin Film Festival just a couple of years ago, actually.
And was our submission for Best Foreign Language Film.
Ah, nice.
But did not get accepted like none of ours ever have.
It's
a Seamus song. Song of Granite.
I was about to say, Song of Granite.
Song of Granite was submitted as well, and should have got in there. It's a great film.
And it's actually perfect because most of it is in Irish as well. All of it's in Irish, pretty much, isn't a lot of it?
I think there should be like a quota that we have to produce at least one really good Irish language film to put forward for the Oscars.
I love the cynicism.
Nobody knows
of that,
what they'd
consider
good, though.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to talk about the top 10. At number 10, Mission Impossible Fallout.
Fab.
It is fantastic.
Film in the summer.
I agree. I'm with Grace on this one.
Well, of the ones I've seen.
Ooh, it's tight.
Yeah,
I need to catch up with this.
I'm with Grace on this. Well, don't worry. I'm sure it won't fall out next week.
It probably will.
It is a tech. We said this last week, though. It just turns out that this week was a staggeringly awful week for new releases.
Yeah.
It has been pretty bad now.
Very few of them actually made the top 10. In fact, I think there's only a handful of them. Mm. At number 9, The Incredibles 2, which has earned 4.2 million euro to date at the Irish box office.
God.
Kids are going back to school now. It starts to climb.
So we'll start to
see fewer of these goddamn kids' movies.
Hey. Never. Many children in the country.
Constantly, and every time it happens, I say, why is the kids film here? You're like, oh, the kids are off school. They're always off school.
They are.
I feel like The Incredibles 2 doesn't necessarily deserve this wrath.
I haven't seen it. I'm sure it's wonderful.
Thank you for that. That was very convincing, Ronan.
Point
yeah,
for
that
was our ire towards the children.
At number 8, and I suspect something that Luke and myself may have something to say, The Happy Time Murders.
Ooh.
The Sad Time Murder. It's terrible.
We appreciate that, thank you for playing.
I don't want to waste too much time on it. It's very
dear,
very
bad,
very sad.
It has been quite roundly despised.
Yeah, it's one of those things that nobody is sort of brushing it off, being like, everyone seems to be like, oh my god,
we're
this is catastrophic.
I don't know if there's a film that I've seen this year that puts quite so little effort into pretty much every aspect of filmmaking other than
the puppets.
The puppetry, which is really good.
The puppetry is really nice. The character designs are great, but the movie itself is just coasting. And like, that's the thing. It's not even like amusingly bad in the way that, like, to pick some random examples, China Salesman starring Steven Seagal and Mike Tyson is bad. This is just like somebody watched Roger Rabbit and said, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? And said, we'll do that, right? But with puppets instead of cartoons, and maybe have a few more sex jokes in there. Yeah. And that's it, really.
That sounds tasteless.
It is just tasteless.
Because it's directed by Brian Henson.
Yes.
I wanted to understand why. Like, full stop, just why, in general, with the film. So, like, I went looking, and apparently they've had this script in a drawer somewhere for years. Yeah. It was sent to him, and he was like, oh, I don't know, it looks bad. I'm paraphrasing slightly. And then just over years, from the way he tells it, it's like he's fobbing off the guy on the screenplay for years, being like, oh, we'll get to it. And now, unfortunately,
they reached the bottom of the pile. I like that.
Henson and some of his friends do like a kind of improv show in LA where the puppets are rude and they say bold words, and it's like, what if we did that as a movie, is basically what
it
is.
But it doesn't even have like the energy that you would associate with an improv night, because nothing in it is particularly creative. Nothing in it is playful. It's literally just
silly string.
Yeah. Really?
Ejaculators.
It's the third best puppet sex scene of the last 20 years, which takes some doing.
Yeah, it was sad.
Yeah, it's very sad. It's not a good movie. It's completely, and it completely wastes a human cast that's full of potential, like Melissa McCarthy, Maya Rudolph. Actually, the best part of the film is when there are no puppets on screen. It's just Maya Rudolph and Melissa McCarthy, but even Elizabeth Banks as well, to pick another example. It's just lifeless.
And people are going to see it.
Yep.
Joy.
Well, a 6-day opening weekend will do that for you.
Mm.
It's always a sign of quality.
It hasn't done especially well, though, has it?
No, it hasn't. It's one of the few new releases to place. The other new release placing this week is Searching at number 7, which I quite enjoyed. It's like Unfriended, but for people who don't know the difference between a laptop and a Mac.
They're not quite ready to commit.
They're not quite ready to commit to it. It's like, there's a big screen there, I'm not sure what I should be watching, and the camera's like, it's okay, I got you. And it's like, okay, this is happening, but I feel like really uncomfortable that I'm just staring at a screen. It's like, okay, don't worry, we'll put in some ambient sound. It's like, it's a weird hybrid
of... That seems a strange betrayal of the point of having these sort of screen cap movies,
yeah,
doesn't it?
It does and it doesn't, because it gets you halfway there. You could never... You could conceivably show movies like Unfriended to,
sure,
like, elderly relatives who are uncool.
Yeah.
They just wonder why you turned the computer into a laptop and why your friends are murdering each other on the Skype. Searching, on the other hand, is much more conventional cinematic language. It even does montages on the screen in a way that is kind of vaguely interesting to watch. It, again, as we mentioned last week, it's from the guy Anish Shaganti, who directed the Google ads. So it's very much in that style. If you can imagine, even say the Social Network trailer, the way in which the camera sort of moves across the screen, in that it has that sort of movement to it as well. Interesting enough, actually, I discovered during the week that the vertical video is now a thing.
What's
vertical video?
You didn't know this?
I only discovered this during the week. Yeah, vertical video.
Yeah, they've been talking about this for a couple of years.
Yeah, it's basically, so you know the way that most phones these days are like widescreen if you hold them like landscape?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you were to turn them 90 degrees, that would be vertical video. So the idea...
That wasn't just like aspect ratio flip.
Just as an aspect ratio flip.
Oh, yeah.
But they're remastering old television shows and movies so that people can watch them on their phones in that way.
Yeah.
So, for example, The X-Files has been remastered, so it can be watched in that way, which is fascinating. And Batman 66
is
another one as well.
Extreme pan and scan. Thing.
Well, I think if you think about it, David Duchovny is probably perfectly designed for that sort of thing. It's like, I can see all of Mulder all the time. It's fantastic.
There was, I think, maybe 2 years ago, Rotterdam, the Film Fest, did a thing where they commissioned films specifically done for a widescreen but flipped.
Yeah.
And it's a really interesting idea.
Yeah, like, I think if you set out to use it in that way, you could probably make some very interesting use of the space.
Mm, yeah,
absolutely.
But I'm not sure how successful it would be flipping old stuff.
Yeah, that's the thing. Stuff that is shot in a completely different way. It doesn't make sense to do that. Commission new things and, you know, explore new possibilities.
I find myself cautiously optimistic about it, and in the same way that I think, like, generations of cinema goers would have discovered these, like, widescreen panoscope sort of movies on the 4x3 television screen and sort of stumbled into this way. I figure, you know, maybe the kids of today are watching The X-Files on the bus ride, and can't turn their screens like 90 degrees. I feel like I'm an old fogey. I feel like I'm complaining about something, like, you know, shaking my fist at the sky, raging at an angry god. But part of me, like, as you know, as much as I accept that it's great that kids are going to watch this in a new format, I'm like, is it really that difficult to just, like, take your two hands?
It is kind of an imposition.
Steven Soderbergh has probably, he read an article about this vertical screen, and he's probably gone and shot five movies on his phone in vertical.
For that aspect, right?
Two TV
already,
shows.
Yeah.
He's remade the X-Files.
As we speak, yeah. as a silent film. At number five, still hanging around in there, it's The Meg. Yeah. Obviously, it made quite a splash with everybody here. It's not
slow
a good
film
movie.
Week.
Yeah, not a good movie at all. For some reason, Jason Statham versus the giant shark is dull. How does that happen?
I'm telling you, the genre peaked with Deep Blue Sea. Also, sharks are being like murdered all across the country, all across the world, and they're endangered species. And people should really stop lampooning them in this manner. This is irresponsible.
We need like a shark advocacy group, really, mm-hmm. or SAG, if you will.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's amazing how bad and dull it is. It's lifeless. It's the same problem with the Happy Time Murders. It'd be good if it were bad, almost. Mm-hmm. Just dull. Speaking of things that are just dull, The Equalizer 2 is at number 5.
I really thought something else was in that slot. I was going to get really upset.
Okay. No shade cast here, Ronan.
Excellent.
The Equalizer 2. What if Denzel Washington was the old man and the sea? At number 4, Hotel Transylvania 3, A Monster Vacation, which is holding on surprisingly
well. Yeah, it's been around
for
a long time now, right?
And, the Monster Vacation is at an end.
No, I think the Monster Vacation will be continuing for some weeks to come.
Tragically.
It's just interesting because a couple of weeks ago it was tied with Incredibles 2, and it's just sort of interesting that Incredibles 2 is full. Now, Incredibles 2 obviously had a much longer run. This is only at 1.8 million to date, but it's still interesting to see such a sharp drop.
Yeah, but where we are now in the school year... That's going to be replaced in the top 10 by Hotel Transylvania 4, Debs.
Yeah. I like the idea of the Hotel Transylvania franchise growing up with its
growing
audience.
Old with its audience, yeah.
It's like, you'll be lucky to go back and watch it and relive your life experiences. I remember where I was when I watched Monster Vacation. At number 3, Mamma Mia, here we go again.
Marvelous.
How long has this been out now?
It hasn't been that long, has it?
It's been about 6 weeks.
Yeah, I listened to the entire soundtrack all the way through again today, like I have for almost every day since I've seen the film.
It's still
a miracle.
Yeah.
It's so good.
It's so joyful.
It's really so nice.
Yeah.
The whole Dancing Queen sequence is the happiest I've been this year, which may be sad, but I was very happy for those three.
Also,
nights.
2018 hasn't been a great year. So
yeah,
I mean,
really
whatever
hasn't.
Joy you can
it
get.
Really
yeah, but even grading on a scale, it's still it's wonderful.
It is.
It
would
be a delight in any year.
Yeah.
I'm really excited to see we're getting to the point where we have sing-along versions entering cinemas. I am
or
so
returning
glad.
To cinemas, I think
returning.
You mean. Because, of course, this is number 3 at the box office at the moment. It's been a terrible absence. I don't know how we survived without it. But the sing-along version is premiering at the Lighthouse this weekend, I believe.
The 16th, is it?
Yep.
It's probably sold out already as well.
No doubt, yeah. I'm sure there'll be plenty of them. And it's really convenient because every time I've gone to see it so far, I've sung along anyway. So, people will stop staring at me. Be nice.
Now other people will join in.
Yeah.
You can harmonize. It's going to be good.
I love the idea of sort of getting the tuning fork out and just being like, yeah, trying to get your perfect.
But that's the beauty of, we can now call it the Mamma Mia franchise, that you don't have to sing well because Pierce Brosnan is on screen.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's
there's
the bar.
No judgment here.
We are all
here.
About love and acceptance. You do you. You live your truth.
At number 2, it's Christopher Robin falling off the top spot. That seems to be the general response that the movie's garnering.
I'm not in for this.
There's so many films on this list where it's just like...
Yeah.
Yeah, we're
I never saw Christopher Robin.
Did you see Goodbye, Christopher Robin?
No.
The deep impact of Christopher Robin movies, as it were. So it's been a sort of a quiet week. I think we're getting to the dog days of summer. Like, we're reaching the point where it's just kind of... coasting lightly
until we get to Oscar season,
which is already kicking off in Venice.
It's what, 2 weeks to First Man here, right? Something like that.
It's more than two weeks. It's
started
October, isn't it? It started October.
Yeah, it's early September
now. Furious reshoots over the flag issue. Jesus. Wait, who made First Man again? Was it what's his face?
Chazelle.
There's no music in it.
In space, no one can hear you scream, but they can hear you save jazz.
I was.
I was in a conversation with a group of people the other day who wound up talking about La La Land for whatever reason, and I'm no major fan of La La Land, let's not go deep
into
it.
We're not going there again.
But somebody said in the vein of recent musicals, they were like, well, Mamma Mia is clearly much better. And obviously, I was like, yes, of course. And they went, but only the first one, not the second.
What?
Yeah. Imagine liking the second Mamma Mia more.
Or no, the first
less,
one.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Mamma Mia is clearly very, very
superior.
I feel obliged as like, as a fan of La La Land to stick my hand up and say I quite like La La Land.
It's funny how the table got set up that way because I like La La Land as well.
I have to say.
I really went to bat for La La Land when it came out. I've actually watched it again recently. I still think it's good.
I wound up in the peculiar situation that time I was talking to people of defending La La Land despite the fact I'm not crazy about it. I like it overall, but...
I'd like there to be a world where we don't have to talk about it or acknowledge it exists.
Well, once First Man comes out,
yeah. That will be its own.
We can all argue over that.
The eagle has La La Landed. Hey. At number one, it's Black Klansman.
Yes.
Climbing from number two. Yes.
Which is really good to see. Yeah, good word of mouth on this one. This was the fourth one of my quadruple bill, and I loved it. Yeah. Really, really, really liked
Fab.
It.
I sent two people from work to see it, both of whom enjoyed.
Yeah, it's terrific.
It's hard to imagine somebody not particularly liking it because it's just got this incredible charm offensive. The point where like the things that are recognized as flaws in it, the stuff mentioned by Bruce Riley, for example, even that seems like it was a conscious choice on the part of Lee to make a movie that could tackle this subject without alienating too many people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And Spike Lee is really, really smart about this kind of thing. He's been doing this for a very long time at this point. He understands the sort of the way in which cinema politics and sociology are all tied up, and he intrinsically understands that in this film. There's an extraordinary sequence where he sort of, amid a discussion of Birth of a Nation, does the cross-cutting that made Birth of a Nation famous.
Yeah.
And he's doing something incredibly smart there. You know, using the political power of cinema and turning back on that, saying this is the way it has shaped American culture, and in a very, very negative way. And actually, we can take back these tools, and we can use them to do the opposite thing, you know. And I think it's my favorite, talking about Dancing Queen earlier, that's now moved to second on my favorite scenes of the year list. The early scene where they do the entire speech from Kwame Ture, and they have that sort of extraordinary sequences of black faces slowly moving forward and moving backwards, and it's lending a sort of aesthetic element to this idea of black beauty, but it also is playing around with the idea of gaze and playing with white gaze, black gaze. It's terrific. And it's all wrapped up in an extremely fun genre film.
Yeah.
It's absolutely one of the films of the year, I think.
Yeah. I would kind of agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of intrinsic film knowledge that Spike Lee has, as you're saying, you can see the memoir on which Black Klansman is based, the real life story, kind of just ends with the whole thing being cancelled and it peters out, whereas in Black Klansman you get kind of a bigger, funner Hollywood ending, and
that's
a Hollywood ending, and then you don't, then you get reality, and it kind of hits you all the harder for that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Black Klansman is it's brilliant, I think, you know, one of the best of the year.
It's very perfect in the way it does these things that, you know, you wind up with an explosive ending that also then just comes to a halt and doesn't really go anywhere, and we suddenly jump 40 years into the future and realize that we haven't moved at all, but we have or haven't we? It's weighing these things in a really interesting way.
And Topher Grace, who knew?
Who could have told him when he was starring in Spider-Man 3 that he would make one of the most convincing screen villains of our time?
Yeah, I came out of Black Klansman and I went on Twitter to write my thoughts about it, and then I realized that the bad guy in Black Klansman is still on Twitter, and then I got really annoyed and just wanted to curl up in a ball.
Yeah.
But it's this extreme thing, and I think that's part of the appeal of the way that Lee plays with genre. You know, he's very much, you know, you're constantly conscious that you're watching a movie because he literally has blaxploitation posters.
As they're having the discussion, they're talking about the films and they're bringing
always
it in.
Is like, this is a movie and it's loads of fun, but this is so real and all of this is happening all around you. These people are pretty, you know, they've got the reins now.
All right, let's move on to talk about the upcoming releases if we want a bit of positivity in our lives.
Yeah.
Opening this week, The Seagull, an adaptation of the Anton Chekhov play, starring Elizabeth Moss, Saoirse Ronan, Corey Stoll, and Annette Bening.
It's a really good cast.
It's a great cast.
It hasn't gone down well so far.
No. I'm not aware of too many people who've seen it. I didn't get any press notifications about it or anything about it. Seems to have.
They're trying to bury it a little bit.
Yeah. Also opening this week, Puzzle, directed by Mark Turtletaub, starring Kelly MacDonald and Ifrin Khan. It's a romantic story set in the world of competitive jigsaw puzzle assembly.
Who knew that was a thing?
It seems like a wonderfully charming movie based on the trailer that I've watched. I haven't had a chance to see it yet, but it does look like it sort of might scratch that sort of Nancy Meyers-esque itch of people who are generally pleasant to one another in a slightly quirky environment.
Efren kind of had good success with that a couple of years back with The Lunchbox. It's good turf for him.
Mark Wahlberg is a competitive jigsaw puzzle player in Mile 22.
In Mile 22, he does the Ben Affleck in The Accountant, which is rare that you watch a sequence and think that Ben Affleck is actually like perfect for it. Because it's like, it's by comparison, rare, yeah. By comparison, it's like, as far as actors who assemble jigsaw puzzles upside down in the past 2 years in cinema, I feel like Affleck has a very clear lead.
It's just like the movie kind of uses jigsaw imagery like the way you would chess imagery between Wahlberg and the villain of the film. And at the end of the film, Wahlberg says, like, you won this game, but the next game. And like assembling jigsaws is not a game.
It's not a competitive
game. Is it genuinely a thing?
It's an activity.
In the film, in Mile 22, yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah, they use jigsaws as a metaphor for competition, which is very strange. But maybe they should just watch Puzzle instead. Now I'm imagining Puzzle with Mark Wahlberg flipping a
throwing the board away, ruining lives.
Really strange when we keep going back to it, but just to draw attention to the simple fact that Mark Wahlberg's character has a rubber band that he wears around his wrist that he flicks in order to slow down his thought. Whenever it feels like his brain is moving too fast for the world, his character nervously flicks this to bring him back to reality. But it also gives Peter Berg something to cut to whenever anything is happening on screen.
You should have got one of those bands that were like all the rage in the 90s where like they were straight and then when you hit them off your wrist, they close around your wrist.
Would be great for a fight song.
Yeah. Could have been multifunctional. I had loads of them. Why were they a thing? In hindsight, they're really weird. Anyway.
We didn't have the internet yet.
Yeah, we didn't.
Have to do something to pass the time. I remember when yo-yos were a thing.
Oh. We had to go outside.
Also opening this week, The Miseducation of Cameron Post.
Ooh, really want to see this.
Which I've heard great things about.
Yeah, it's got really good reviews. And Desiree Akhavan, the director, last did Appropriate Behavior, which I loved a lot. It's a really fun film, which she starred in herself. There was an interview with her in the Irish Times this week where she was talking about how with this film she wanted to wrest back narratives of female homosexuality from male directors, as they mostly have been done, and so I'm really looking forward to seeing it. I wanted to catch it at Gaze, but I knew it had a release coming out in a couple of weeks, so I went for something that wasn't going to come out instead, but I'll definitely be catching it this week.
Also out this week, Final Score, the Sky Movies film, which is releasing simultaneously on Sky Movies and also in cinemas. It's a movie in which Dave Bautista plays a veteran soldier who has to defend a stadium full of innocent people who are being held hostage by nasty Pierce Brosnan.
Which is the quickest I've ever gone from no interest to loads.
The Brosnan-sance continues.
How do you hold an entire stadium of people hostage?
Well, I imagine he has goons. One hopes it's not just Pierce Brosnan wandering around the aisle with a gun.
He's that compelling.
But yeah, I'm kind of...
Look at me.
Like, and I love the fact that it's available to watch on Sky from tomorrow, so I can watch it without feeling guilty. Mm-hmm. I don't even have to go out to watch this movie. Yeah. Come on, tell me, that's actually
a good call, because this sounds like the type of thing you very much like leave on if you came across it at home, but you would never pay to go and see it in a cinema.
Was Anon the first one they did that day and date tactic with? Cinema.
Oh, yeah, the one with Clive.
They not do something before Anon.
Was there another one as well?
Wasn't there something with like a hurricane or?
Oh yes, Hurricane Heist.
Oh yeah,
that was them.
How did they? Yeah. How did those do? Did they perform well in cinema? Presumably,
they seem to do well enough that they're doing it again. Yeah. And I mean, I know that Hurricane Heist made the top 10. I think Anon maybe made 10 as well.
Okay.
It's fascinating. Like it's a weird little like anti Netflix thing.
It's nice to have that option. A lot of people want to go out and enjoy a Friday night at the cinema. They don't want to miss the conversation about that film. So
I suspect it may also be rooted in the fact that a Sky subscription is more expensive than a Netflix subscription. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Also out this week, American Animals, which I think most of us have seen.
I haven't.
I've seen it.
Yes, me too.
Sorry, Ronan's trepidation there in mentioning.
I seem to be the only person who didn't really like this, which, you know, good for Barry Layton. I liked The Imposter a lot, but with this I felt the effort to do the same sort of
interrogating the boundaries of fiction and subjectivity just didn't work when it was mostly given over to fiction. There are a lot of points where he'll like drop in the real life subjects in the place of the actors. I didn't feel it worked very often. It sort of raised these questions of, you know, what are the boundaries of my perception of this versus your perception? And those are interesting questions, but they don't really have relevance to the film as he presents it, I think. I would also direct people to read Darren's piece on it. It's very, very good. You delve into the issues about the way it deals with American poverty, and not even poverty, but just ideas of people being a bit bored and wanting to do something with their lives. I just don't think it does anything with that. That's all there. I don't think going anywhere.
But. I mean, it taps into that sort of same masculine anxiety that informed stuff like Fight Club 20 years ago. It's that same sort of listlessness and sense of going nowhere and sense of entitlement that comes with privilege. Mm-hmm. There's a great line in it where the characters are talking about how they decide to rob this book of priceless artwork from a college on the basis that to do this thing would require exceptional effort. Not ordinary effort. Exceptional effort. And it's weird because it's a movie that's structured so that this horrible thing that happens, this attempted heist, happens purely because these bunch of white guys who want something meaningful in their lives have no obstacle in their way to stop them from doing this horrible thing, which is fascinating. I mean, my issue with it is more that it signposts its ending very early on. It's very clear where the movie's going to come down and what its judgment is going to be. In fact, it even cuts away to that judgment and then cuts back in a way that makes it very clear how the movie's going to end or how this sort of narrative is going to unfold, which makes it feel like it takes a long time to say something that seems very self-evident.
That's exactly my problem with this. You liked it more, I think.
Okay. What about yourself, Luke?
I definitely see what you're saying. I kind of think that the cutting back to the real life perpetrators of this crime, it doesn't really, in the end, play into the points that the movie is trying to make, or feels like it's trying to make. But I did find the film entertaining enough that, you know, I really quite enjoyed it. I thought the performances in it were really good. I thought it was really well made. But yeah, I could definitely see how it doesn't really add up to as much as maybe it was aiming for.
Well, I think totally it's very enjoyable to watch, the, you know, as it's flying along. It's really well shot, and he's good at doing these kind of things. I'd love to see him make a full-blown narrative feature because the way he plays around with documentary and narrative form and this idea of subjectivity, it feels like he doesn't get to the roots of this idea of exceptionalism, as you say, which is where the film may have its best interest. So it feels like it never gets to say anything, but it's desperately trying to say something, which takes away from the entertainment.
It's playing with the perceptions of its characters and, you know, how they remember certain things happening and how they perceive themselves.
Sure.
And if it did that more, it has kind of two ideas of play, which is that and then the ideas of the acceptableism. And these are just privileged but average stupid boys.
Yes.
And it really could have brought those two things together by playing up how they see themselves and how they remember themselves and how they remember this thing, which is the most significant thing in their lives.
And will be, despite being a complete colossal failure.
And it could have been more glamorized and more kind of playful with that. And it peters a bit because it doesn't do that, but it's very well put together. It's got really good performances.
I love the performance of Think and Doubt, especially when she turned up. That and Hereditary together, she's had such
Doubt
a good
is amazing.
Year.
Like, even watching like television, like, she's phenomenal in The Leftovers. She's also great in The Handmaid's Tale. Wait, The Handmaid's Tale.
Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah, The Handmaid's Tale will be a completely different crossover experience. but yeah, she's absolutely great, and I'm glad that she sort of had that experience. Recently. Opening this week is The Nun from Warner Brothers, the latest entry in what seems to be the second most successful shared universe that any major studio has managed to build over the past decade, the Conjuring shared universe. This is the origin story of the nun who made a small appearance in The Conjuring 2 and now gets a full-blown origin story set in Romania in 1952.
I think it sounds interesting.
It's a very interesting film in the same way that all these Conjuring films are interesting films, in part because they exist in this weird liminal space between conventional old school, and again, even though it's set in 1952, 70s new Hollywood sort of horror movies like The Exorcist or The Amityville Horror or stuff like that, and the modern sensibility of the blockbuster, which is like this big budget spectacle with stars that you recognize or actors that you recognize with sort of trappings and scale and sort of like challenges and like stakes. And there's this weird space between the two where the films seem to exist. And The Nun sort of arrives in the same place The Conjuring 2 does, where it has this really, really, really good opening sort of like premise. Because it's more of a mood and aesthetic. It's set in a Romanian monastery, a Romanian sort of covenant in 1952. But it's not Romania in 1952. There's no mention of the communist regime. There's no mention of like the persecution of Catholics or the attempts to deal with like the Orthodox Church in Romania at the time. It's more interesting like, hey, this is the closest we're going to get to setting a movie in Transylvania in the 30s. So like the opening scene sets the tone perfectly, where a bunch of nuns walk down a corridor inside a covenant that is littered with almost comically oversized, like Fritz Langian style sort of crosses and crucifixes that are dangling and protruding at odd angles. There's mist and fog on the floor, despite the fact that we are seemingly locked inside a covenant. And there's
a
door that leads to a mysteriously dark room in which something horrible is lurking. It gets a lot of mileage out of this sort of premise. Like, it stars Damien Bashir as a priest who's sent by the Vatican to investigate the mysterious death of a nun at this convent. And he's shot repeatedly. Like, the movie seems to be, like, 50% shots of him entering and leaving buildings in the style of The Exorcist. And it kind of works. Mm. It's charming enough to get you there. He's, like, this sort of, like, Vatican style molder who's investigating these weird cases. There's all this like really great imagery, like blood that keeps flowing, like the blood of Christ, wine, you know, this little trace of wine that's left in the funeral sort of drape. There's this ring of gigantic Gothic 1930s Universal style graveyard that has been built to encircle the convent, leading to the line, "I feel like these crucifixes aren't designed to keep evil out, but instead to lock evil in." And even then you get like this sort of broad horror stuff where it's like, oh, the Catholic Church, there's something horrible here. What if there was something horrible and grotesque buried in the foundations of this place? And, you know, the fact the priest is haunted by the image of like a little boy who seems to follow him around everywhere. Now, it doesn't actually work. It doesn't cohere any of those into anything particularly gripping or compelling. But there's enough there that's sort of interesting. It kind of falls apart a little bit when it gets to doing the blockbustery stuff. So you have like the eponymous nun has like an action movie villain one-liner where she grabs the lead character who tried to run away and says, "You should have kept running." And then they have like a big fight sequence in which they're grappling in water, like something from Ron Howard's Inferno. It's something to behold. There's a sense that the movie, which only runs a brisk 96 minutes, to be fair to it, has been sort of like cut apart in the ending room, where like the exposition stuff that interrupts the sequences involves like weird lines like, you know, the strange Gothic history, which involves references to like Gilles de Rais. And then it's like, oh, and then the war and the bombs came. And you just get this like 10-second shot of the shadows of bombers over the Romanian countryside. It's like, this is all we have here. It's very strange. There's a moment where Bisher picks up this holy relic and shows it to the rest of the cast. And one member of the cast says, in that blockbuster one-liner way, "Holy shit!" To which Bisher responds, "The holiest."
Sorry.
It's all, that's kind of amazing.
You're selling me.
Yeah, you sold everyone with that.
Tell me that doesn't seem compelling and interesting. Like The Conjuring 2, which is an exorcist possession horror movie that features a car chase. It's like, there's some sort of weird fusion.
Why can't we splice these genres?
Well, that's it together.
Give
like,
it a stab.
Yeah, The Exorcist is 45 years old. Might as well crack it open.
But that's it exactly. I mean, we talked in the podcast before about the horror that was the Universal shared dark universe. And the weirdness of trying to stitch like 1930s Universal horror movies into a blockbuster template, including like Tom Cruise and Russell Crowe. What's interesting about like The Conjuring shared universe is that Wan seems to do that, and he did that by, instead of drawing from the 30s, drawing from the 70s. So he gets like that sort of parallel evolution of New Hollywood, where Jaws was side by side by The Exorcist. So it's like this weird, almost like meeting of cousins to create something that you never thought you'd see. You're not entirely sure you can comprehend, but it's familiar enough and yet strange enough that you want to go with it. It's gonzo. It's not brilliant, it's not fantastic. If you like the other Conjuring movies, you'll probably like it. If you don't like the other Conjuring movies, you probably won't. But hey, it's efficient, it's charming, and it does some nice stuff with kind of computer-generated imagery, where it uses it to create something that's genuinely uncanny, as opposed to trying to create something that replicates normality. The big release of the week, the final release of the week, is Black 47. the Irish famine western that you didn't know that you needed. I believe myself and Grace have seen this one.
I've seen it too.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, yeah.
So, what do we make of it?
I liked it. I think I liked it quite a lot. You know, aside from gratuitous violence against pigs, which I was not a fan of. Sorry. No, it's good. It's really interesting. It's one of those films that makes you wish we had more diverse filmmaking going on in Ireland, by which I mean people trying different genres and different stories and trying to put some more of a personal twist on things, which is something that I think not so much filmmakers here don't try it, but that the industry perhaps does not support this kind of thing. But yeah, the story itself is kind of generic revenge sort of thriller thing, but seeing it set against that kind of landscape, and especially in the context of the famine with all of the deprivation and the, you know, the politics of it and just the way the landscape is used, it's so harsh and austere and it's set in kind of winter. Yeah, like it becomes a lot more intense, I think, for that. So it's good. It's well worth a look.
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed it too. I don't think I enjoyed it quite as much as
Darren is pumping his ass in here.
Yeah, but I still think it's a must-see for Irish audiences. Mm-hmm. I think the comparison to a Western has kind of been widely thrown around, and it, you know, that's definitely valid. But the thing that I came out of Black 47 thinking of is kind of exploitation films.
Yep.
And you know, kind of blaxploitation films or things of that nature. Now, obviously,
Pamsploitation film.
Gwalesploitation, you could say. Now, obviously, sociologically, it is slightly different, but this is empowering a group of people that were, in a certain time period, powerless and kind of throwing the power imbalance back in the faces of their oppressors. It's just, it's happening during the famine, and that's really unique, and that's really interesting, and it's really entertaining. There's certainly plenty of Western imagery in it, but things like the pig mutilation, which is gross and not very pleasant.
Unwarranted.
But that, to me, caused some...
But at least they go whole hog with it.
Stop it.
Damn right.
This is a very serious subject.
But that, to me, kind of brings to mind something like Foxy Brown, you know, and her big revenge at the end of that movie and things of that nature. You know, it is a roaring rampage of revenge. Yeah. It's very propulsive. It's very
beautifully shot. It's heavily stylized. Grace pointed out like the way the landscape shot, as if the land itself is dying. There are moments where it almost seems like a zombie movie, where you're watching the sort of the shuffling of people who have obviously been sort of like displaced during the famine, but who are like the walking dead.
I do find it kind of surprising that we haven't had more films about the famine in that sense. Like, and not like genre films about it. Just think of the ghost stories and, you know, that sort of angle that you could take on it. But it's just not something that seems to pop up in our cinematic landscape very often.
Hopefully this is kind of a corner turn for that, because, you know, another thing that would set this apart from exploitation films is that this has had a lot of backing.
Yeah.
Like, this is the
biggest Irish release of all time. It's opening in 100 cinemas in the north and south of the island, which is remarkable.
Yeah, we ran a competition today on Film in Dublin for two tickets to see it tomorrow at the Stella. There was a big response. People are excited for this one. I think they're responding to the push that it's gotten, and deservedly so. It's a very well done film.
Perfect. We'll be discussing it sometime next week. But in the meantime, guys, if people are looking for a bit more Grace, Ronan, or Luke in their lives, where can they find you?
Well, I guess you could find me on Twitter at PixieGrace, but I am on a Twitter break at the moment, and my account is also private. So you can try and find me. I'll be back at some point.
Catch me on Twitter at Baron Ronan, and pick up every edition of Sinair to hear me banging on about Irish queer cinema.
Also that.
I am on Twitter at Mr. Cynical, that's cynical with an I, and you can also find me on filmindublin.ie.
Perfect. You can find me at Darren_Scroney. I also co-host another podcast, The 250, where this week we're discussing Netflix is the Open House, which is the first Netflix movie to feature on either the top 250 or the bottom 100. I'll let you guess which one
bottom
it landed on.
Assuming.
Yeah, it is a horror movie about how creepy open houses are, where a character stops in the middle to explain how creepy open houses are. Find out what myself and Andrew made it of this weekend. In the meantime, take it easy, guys. We'll be back next week. Bye.
Bye.
I can't believe you recorded a whole podcast in the open house.